Norman Krieger was just 15 years old when he was given a scholarship to study with Adele Marcus at the Juilliard School of Music. One of the things she really focused on was how important the tone was to creating a beautiful piece of music. Norman explains what that means as we learn more about his new Brahms recording. This is New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Amacher. Well, Norman, tell me a little bit about your relationship with the London Symphony Orchestra, with whom you made your most recent recording.
Well, that was actually my first experience with them, so it was a great privilege and joy. I mean, I've been a fan my entire life of that orchestra, their wealth of recordings and great history of music making with so many distinguished conductors and soloists. So this was quite a vetting sort of experience for me, I mean, to jump in there and record this particular concerto.
Yeah, and you did so at Abbey Road Studios, too. Wow.
Yes, that was a great thrill.
Are you a Beatles fan?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so you were on hallowed ground there making that recording?
Right. It was quite something. I mean, the particular room that we recorded in, it was built for Sir Edward Elgar, I believe. And the room is, you know, it's like a big box. So one doesn't really get the feedback that one would have, let's say, in a concert hall. So one has to really trust your producers and engineers for balance, etc.
Well, let's dive right into the two pieces that are featured on this recording. I find it kind of interesting that Brahms was a pianist, yet the music that he wrote for the instrument isn't necessarily comfortable under the fingers, almost even awkward sometimes. Did you find that to be true with this second piano concerto?
I think that's true with everything Brahms wrote, personally. I don't think there's one piece of music for piano that really is comfortable. I don't know any pianist, quite frankly. I have not met one single pianist that would say that anything that Brahms wrote feels necessarily comfortable. And that's actually part of the idiosyncratic nature of him as a composer, I think, is that one is always working through harmonies, and sometimes the physiology of the hand in relation to those harmonies is quite a struggle. Fortunately, I have a pretty large hand. I can reach an 11th, and the fleshy part of my palm is very suited, I think, to Brahms's sound world, so that helps. But still, even with those assets, I think that there are just challenges, you know, from the first note to the last note.
Well, and it took several years for pianists to finally adapt to the work. It wasn't until a few pianists like Arthur Rubinstein and Arthur Schnabel that it really came to the forefront.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, with all due respect to both of those gentlemen who I, you know, worshipped as a kid and still do as an adult, in this day and age, one can't get away with many of the things that those gentlemen did. I feel like I'm saying something sacrilegious here, but the fact of the matter is, in the earlier part of the 20th century, a lot of pianists sort of, you know, there were substitutions technically for very difficult passages. And in this modern age, one is expected to play all the notes. And so even in a recording session, you know, you can't get away without the stellar crystal clarity of every single note in that piece. There's no place to hide, you know, with digital recording, etc. So I feel that was sort of a lifetime achievement award for me personally. You know, having played that concerto many, many times in concert, the good news was that when we recorded this, we didn't have many takes. The first movement, I think, was done pretty much in one or two takes, but there were huge stretches of sections. So it was not a myopic sort of surgical recording. You know, there were edits for balance, etc., but I was proud of myself because I worked so hard to prepare this piece to make sure that, you know, everything was as good as I could possibly do on that day, which is all that we can do as artists.
Yeah, well, you have every reason to be proud. What do you find most satisfying about performing this work, which really is kind of the Mount Everest of piano concertos, or one of them?
Yes, it really is. I think for me, you know, the collaboration certainly with Philip Brian Mann and the London Symphony, that is, you know, it's like chamber music on a grand scale. So we all have to meet in a concerto like this on the same page, meaning conceptually. It's not like another kind of concerto where there can be more operatic aspects. When I say that, you know, the soloist sort of takes over in you know, other styles, etc. With Brahms, it's the writing is so symphonic and so woven into the fabric of the orchestration. The thrill for me is, you know, especially when we're playing together some very large stretches, very, you know, huge gestures of phrasing and dialogue between the piano and the orchestra. I can't think of anything that's more satisfying than that. You really feel like you're surfing a wave for 50 minutes almost. It's really the high point artistically for me. I think that concerto and maybe Beethoven 4, you know, other solo pieces and some, you know, a lot of chamber music, of course. But, you know, this concerto, you can never, how can I say this? You can't really let your guard down. You always have to pay attention. And I think the primary asset as a performer is to really work in such a way where you're listening 110% from the beginning to the end. And that helps you become a vessel for the music and to relax with the piece a little bit. Because, you know, it's interesting, when I was very young and I learned this concerto, the first two movements, even though it is like, as you said, climbing Mount Everest, there is a certain Teutonic edge to the first two movements in a way where, you know, you really are sort of climbing the mountain and, you know, dealing with the elements as they hit you as you're climbing upward. But then, as I've gotten older and I understand the architecture a little bit differently now, I find that this is very mature Brahms. You know, it's very different from the first concerto. And he understands the accumulation of harmonies and dynamics and the intensity of the line. And there's such a long stretch in the exposition and then in the recapitulation of the first movement of dynamics, where you're starting at forte and then you work your way all the way up to fortissimo. Too soon, it's, you know, it's not going to work, and we are going to overplay. So that's something that I've worked very hard at over the years, to find that balance, and so that I can plan dynamically where I'm going and meet the orchestra at their fortissimo.
It's interesting because you talk about how you can't get away without playing all the notes with this anymore, right? Mm. And then the way you just describe this, it's literally like you're preparing for a marathon.
Yeah, it's one of the most athletic pieces, I think, written for the piano. I mean, it's you know, one of these big, iconic masterpieces that you have to be in a certain physical state. As one of my colleagues said to me once, he said, you know, it's quite an achievement just to get from the beginning to the end, just to play all the notes and just to get through it. Because, you know, 50 minutes is a good chunk of time. And even though I must confess, in performance, it doesn't feel like 50 minutes. it goes by, it's the equivalent of, you know, theory of relativity, I guess, but it feels like 15 or 20 minutes while you're playing it on stage, because you're so focused and sort of in a different zone.
Speaking of your zone, is there a point as you're playing this work when all of a sudden you realize you are in the zone? Like, you know, with many things, it kind of takes you a little while, you know, like just say you are running a marathon and it would take you a little while to kind of get into your groove. Is there a point when you're playing this piece where you realize, oh, there I am, I'm right there in the groove?
The consistent place where I feel the most content and connected, I would say, are the 12 bars in the third movement with the piano and the clarinet. I think those 12 measures are as close to one can get to divinity in this life, at least in sound. What Brahms does is he just creates this opening of absolute serenity and contentment. You know, I mean, it's as good as it gets, and it's the essence of, you know, what one might call love or faith. It's a transcendental moment for me. I mean, it's really quite magical what Brahms does. And also, you know, when you hear it, it doesn't sound this way, but you're basically, as a pianist, in very slow motion, you're covering practically the entire range of the keyboard. So, you know, we're sort of floating in outer space in a way.
It's funny you would say that, because I literally made a note that it's almost as if we've left the planet during that movement.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there is something really quite miraculous, I would say, and revelatory. In a way, you know, there are no words that can really describe it, because that's why we have the music, I guess.
Now, I know you were 15 years old when you were given a scholarship to study with Adele Marcus at the Juilliard School of Music. And one of the things that she has said, or did say, is that it was really important for a pianist to have tone. And tone is so critical with this piece of music. And I'm wondering if you can explain what she meant by that tone and how you bring that to the forefront in your playing.
One of the things that Miss Marcus always talked about was using the piano as an instrument, not an end in itself. And that the 10 fingers were 10 singers. So we have our soprano section in the upper, weakest part of our right hand, and then the alto section, and then the tenor section in the left hand, and the bass section with the lower finger. So that was one aspect. And I think in the music of Brahms, you are basically dealing with choir music, with a lot of different variations and shapes of arpeggios and touches, chords, etc. But everything needs to be voiced really the way a choir conductor would conduct a choir. Brahms in particular offers us, I think, an opportunity to express sonorities that are so rich and so deep that one should never really, you know, fight the piano. So in other words, with Miss Marcus, for example, just the physical approach to the instrument was about drawing the sound from the fall board toward you. so that when you would play a chord or even a single note, that you wouldn't fall straight down on the note with a curved finger, but you would use the pad, the cushion of your finger, which is a little bit flatter, and you would draw from the fall board toward you, if that makes sense. And so that right there, that changes the sonority of the sound. It gives it a little bit more depth and warmth. And so I think that's very suited to Brahms's music.
Brahms wrote three sonatas for the piano, and you've chosen the Sonata No. 1 in C major, Opus 1, to be paired on this recording with that second piano concerto. Why?
Well, you know, that's Opus 1. And even though it wasn't the first sonata, I mean, the F-sharp minor, which is the second one, was really the first one, I thought it would be interesting to pair the young Brahms and the mature Brahms. You know, the opening of the first sonata is a clear tribute to Beethoven with the same rhythm that Beethoven uses in the opening of the Hammerklavier. It's the exact same rhythm. The harmonies that he then evolves in the first movement of the Opus 1 is similar to the Waldstein Sonata of Beethoven, Opus 53. But again, it's like a symphony. Actually, all three sonatas are so symphonically written that one sort of needs to transcend the piano and use the piano like an orchestra and to articulate thematic material and secondary material the way an orchestra would project it.
What has performing these works by Brahms taught you about yourself?
Oh my gosh. Well, it always keeps me very humble. But more importantly, I think that it's an ongoing process. There's no cap on the ceiling, you know, there's no roof here. It's open-ended, and you know, this recording was one day or 2 days in my life, but the process of learning and growing continues. And so as long as I can still play it, I'm just so grateful to have the privilege to hopefully represent Brahms in a way that he would be happy with.
That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julia Mocker.